Tegan.
And I'm Eric.
This is season 2 of the Professional Weaver Podcast, where each week we have discussions with weavers and the supply chain that supports us with hopes to build depth, transparency, and connection within the hand weaving community.
This week's episode was sponsored by Comfort Cloth Weaving, a company specializing in heirloom quality handwoven products for the home, as well as yardage for the fashion and accessories industries and value-added products for farmers and wool growers. Find out more at comfortclothweaving.com.
We would like to thank all of our patrons of the podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, go to proweaverpod.com/support to make a one-time or monthly support contribution. This week, we are speaking with Daryl Lancaster from New Jersey. Daryl Lancaster, a hand weaver and fiber artist known for her award-winning hand-woven fabric and garments, has been constructing garments for more than half a century. She gives lectures and workshops to guilds, conferences, and craft centers all over the United States. The former features editor for Hand Woven Magazine, she has written more than 100 articles and digital content, frequently contributes to various weaving and sewing publications, including Threads Magazine. She now has a YouTube channel, The Weaver Sews, where she shares her extensive experience sewing hand-woven garments. She now offers a complete line of digital sewing patterns for hand weavers. Daryl also maintains a blog at www.weaversew.com. Find her and all the work that she has done at www.daryllancaster.com. I first met Daryl when she was teaching at Harrisville Designs in New Hampshire. During her course, I would spend late nights talking about my business and what I wanted to do, and she would give me great insights and encouragement on how to grow and develop my own voice. She is an amazing teacher and friend, always rooting me on with whatever endeavors I choose to take on. We hope you enjoy our conversation as we talk about her beginnings as a weaver, how her career evolved over time, and how she is adapting her work to the digital market. We had so much fun talking that we went a little long during our interview, so we broke up the interview into 2 episodes. Part 1 will be this week, and part 2 will be next.
This week, we're going to jump in right where we left off last week.
Yeah, so, I identify with that a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can't turn those orders down because that's what puts food on your table.
Right. Right.
You know, it's a constant dilemma of being true to your own vision and yet making a living. And they are sometimes not compatible.
Right.
Yeah.
But I applaud that. And that was kind of how I felt as it became obvious that one by one as like conferences and everything were just ending this year. I started to think, you know, I don't want this year to look back and think, what a waste. You know, I've always said that I couldn't do things because I didn't have the time. And now I do. And so, you know, not knowing that this pandemic was coming up, you know, and having my daughter move back home for other reasons with her 5 looms and thinking I had a loom in every room of the house. It was absolutely an untenable situation. And then I remember two Octobers ago, waking up one morning and this voice in my head. You know, as you're kind of in that twilight sleep, you get great ideas. And this voice in my head said, just renovate the garage below you. Yeah. And I thought, you know, I came awake and I thought, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life. Why would I do that? And I rolled over and I remember putting the pillow over my head and this voice wouldn't shut up. And so I called my handyman and I said, this voice keeps telling me to run. I said, what do you think? And he looked around, and he goes, well, first you got to get rid of everything that's in here. You have no idea. I mean, my late husband saved everything. And so that in itself was a challenge. But the point is that the heating system, you know, which is, it's a ductless HVAC system that goes into the block wall of the garage, mm-hmm. was put in this, you know, like last week, a year ago. And so it's like, it got put in. So I had this new studio, which I couldn't even use because I had to get on a plane immediately and go to Oregon to teach. And so when I walked back in and the world shut down, I stood in the middle of this studio and I smiled. And I was like, wow, what an incredible gift to have this new space to explore, to be creative in. And, you know, And then last October was Spinning and Weaving Week, and the Hand Weavers Guild of America asked me to be a part of that and do this virtual studio tour because they had heard I had this new studio. And so I wanted to get every floor loom, you know, on the floor warped. So it really looked productive. Right. And that was so much fun to have the time to just, oh, let's put this on this loom. And oh, what about if we do that on that loom? And ooh, I need to do a run of dish towels for the, you know, winter, because that's what I give as my holiday gifts. And so let's get those on. It's only October. And, you know, and I have yarn and I have dyes and I really didn't have to buy anything, like you said. Yeah. And to be able to kind of run like a kid in a candy shop in this new space and just look at everything you've got and acquired and say, I'm free to do this, mm-hmm. can go both ways. You could be so overwhelmed that you don't even know where to begin, or you can just close your eyes and jump into the deep end of the pool and see where it takes you.
Yeah. Mm.
And fortunately, I'm of that personality. Because yeah. I know too yeah. many people that got overwhelmed by this year and just did nothing. And, you know, you can't say they regret it because they just couldn't do it.
Right.
And I feel badly for that loss of a year and for the inability to take the smallest thing and run with it. Because yeah. that is a gift. And not everybody has that. Not everybody has that thought process and that confidence to just close your eyes and jump in the deep end of the pool and see where it takes you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that has helped our ability to do that, where in other situations may not be the best in terms of helping us. This year was a great help and advantage to us, just like the inability to kind of stop, because as soon as things stop, then my mind goes, okay, what's next? Like I just get bored. You know, if I'm not doing something that's either I'm learning something new or actively engaging my brain doing, then I just get bored and depressed. And it's like, ugh, you know, I got to find something that's at least semi-interesting, if not straight up challenging. So, yeah, I think that this year helped us an immense amount. And we also, right before we went to Baltimore, moved into my childhood home, which is right across the driveway from where my dad last year, or not last year,
2 years
2019,
ago.
Built himself a new house, because in 2016, my mom passed away. And he wanted us to move down here so that we could be together and help with the property. And there's a lot of property here. It's a lot to manage. So, you know, we moved down here like just in the nick of time. Mm-hmm. And it all sort of like came together in this weird, perfect symmetry of much like you, you know, how it all kind of just worked out right. Yeah. And we had the support, and we yeah. had somebody to cook dinner a couple nights a week when we didn't have the money to do it or didn't have time or whatever it was, you know?
There's a lot of parallels here, Eric. I totally get it. And, you know, I have to think, you know, if you think, you know, maybe your mom was, you know, looking out that guided you into this position to be okay during this. Maybe my late husband was looking out. I mean, you know, yeah. I don't know. I don't know how quite the afterlife works, but it did. And we are okay. You know, people say, well, how are you doing with all this? And you know, you really are hesitant to say, oh, I've never been better. Because right? that's kind of a dismissal of, you know, how the rest of the world is struggling. But, you know, I am incredibly grateful every morning that I have been given this gift. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do with this YouTube channel. I don't make any money off of it. I don't have enough subscribers to monetize it, really. I just want to be able to put what's in my head that I've acquired over that, you know, 40, 50, 60 years of information and put it into a way that's accessible beyond me. And, yeah. You know, and that's the best way that I can share the benefits that I've gotten this year with those maybe that didn't have that same gift.
Mm. Right. And I think there's something to be said for creatives at this point where they're either feeling overwhelmed or they're feeling the need to create a legacy And I think that has been such a huge, there's been a dichotomy between the two, but I think they're starting to feed into each other because the people who are struggling are seeing these people who are like, all right, I'm ready to put my knowledge out there and share it with the world. Like, this is the perfect opportunity. They're like, oh, maybe I can take a little bit of this knowledge and get back into it. Yes. And refine my joy in the process. So even though there's that disappointment of seeing some of your friends struggle, they're going to start picking up on the things that you're putting out. And we're just all going to eventually lift back up together.
Thank you for that. And that's kind of why the whole joy I had of teaching was empowering others to do it themselves. Yeah. And, you know, I am not the kind of person that, well, I might bring you dinner or two, but we can't in this time of COVID. So, you know, big relief there. but I can show you or suggest to you maybe a way that might inspire you to look at life in a different perspective and get inspired again. And I have those emails coming in all the time, you know, wow, you know, your YouTube channel. I mean, I used to sew a lot and I'm starting to become a weaver. And now I think I can put the two together, you know, based on watching your videos. And I'm thinking, yes, that's what I want. I want to be able to take what I know and give you that gift of empowerment and spark that interest and give you the tools to take this adventure on your own. Mm-hmm. And that is, that's a super important legacy for me to leave behind as long as I can keep doing it. You know?
Yeah.
Specifically in weaving, I think that there is so kind of, little recording of how things work and techniques and just sort of passing on of knowledge in a way that is accessible so that future generations can kind of learn and really absorb that information. Like as time goes on, that I think what you're doing is awesome because it's in a way recording in this kind, you know, barring a solar flare that wipes out every piece of digital information, will be around forever. You know, I mean, YouTube's not going to go anywhere, and the data that they have, they're going to keep forever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so cool to be putting that knowledge out there. And I think that so many people are afraid of putting their knowledge out there because they think, well, if I give other people my knowledge, then that means that I no longer am as valuable. But I think that that is a misconception. Maybe it's generational. Maybe it happens in education process. I'm not sure where it happens exactly, but I feel like, at least in weaving and really in many professions or skills, that if we all share our knowledge, mm-hmm. it only helps progress and advance and make the art of whatever we're doing, in this case weaving, right. better.
Yeah, the one thing though that's interesting that I've had to kind of grapple with it. I mean, nobody's called me on it yet, and I'm sort of waiting for that. But the one thing that I had to kind of grapple with, because a lot of people are asking me, oh, in these videos, can you also shoot how you weave and your decisions here and you're making yardage for clothing and all that? The difficulty is that I'm doing these YouTube channels and putting them out there, and it's free to watch.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what I don't want to do is take away someone else's ability to earn money as a teacher, because there are a lot of teachers out there who have scrambled with trying to develop online classes that, you know, they would get then paid for. And so I've tried really hard to keep what I'm giving, my knowledge, in a field that there isn't a lot of information out there. And that's sewing with handwoven fabric. I mean, mm-hmm. there are some people who teach, you know, some classes, but what I'm doing doesn't really interfere with that.
Right.
I hope. And, you know, and I have to, like, there's some questions even in the AMA that I have to video that involve that. And I want to be careful, because I also don't want to take away someone's ability to earn a living. And I think that, Eric, that's really the problem of it, is that by putting it out there and leaving this legacy, you also might take away someone's ability to actually make a living for themselves. And like, you know, the online yoga classes. I mean, I watch YouTube for my yoga classes. And yes, this person has a big enough following that it's being monetized, and I'm sure they're earning a living from it. But it also takes away from the local yoga studio, who's desperate because, you know, they can't have in-person classes. Mm. And yet it's a fine line to balance the whole digital world with the reality of hands-on work. And I know that integrity in business has been one of the biggest things that has formed who I am as a professional weaver and businesswoman. And, you know, when that taking someone else's work or knowledge and then putting it out there, which prevents them from kind of, you know, earning their own living, you know, it's a fine line. And so this is something that I struggle with in what I put out there and how I answer questions. And, you know, how I eventually, I would love to do a video of my entire studio and, you know, every single project I have and how it works, but that's not exactly fair.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is something that I still struggle with. And I know a lot of the old guard weavers who've now since passed have actually left their legacy is to just donate their entire archives of notes and drafts and books that they've, and to donate it to a place like handweaving.net. So, which is becoming this immense archive of all things in the world. Yeah. Like, there's something like 75,000 drafts in there, but, you know, and yes, they're all copyrighted, you know, just because you saw it on there doesn't mean you can run amok with it. But that said, that content is important to live on beyond us. And many people don't have the ability, the technical ability to do things like a YouTube channel, but mm-hmm. they leave the entire volume, you know, their entire library, whatever, to be able to be digitized in a place like handweaving.net. So I think it is a responsibility that we have, you know, that when our time is done, that we leave behind that knowledge base and continue it. And so that's really what, you know, you're referring to, Eric. And I think it is a responsibility for creative people that it doesn't die with you, which is why we have museums, you know, that work lives on and it tells a story. And now it's interesting because a lot of the stories are changing as we begin to really reevaluate artists and their models and their relationships with their models and, you know, some of the content that they had. And how do you now talk about that in a new dialogue? But I think it's a very valuable dialogue. And I think it's important to be contextual about it and understand how different the world is now. And, yeah. and I think that's a good thing.
Mm. I think so too. And also the great, I always come back to this point with the accessibility, like being able to put this information out on YouTube is making it accessible to people who might not have otherwise been able to afford to go to a class or be able to go travel to where you are. Right. Like it makes it, it evens out the playing field for people, I feel like. And that is such a huge thing for me because weaving is kind of this elite craft. Like you have to afford to be able to get a loom and the materials and all of this. But if you can break it down in a way, it's like you can make these things with handwoven fabrics, but you don't necessarily need a fancy floor loom to do it. You can make fabric on a rigid heddle loom. You can do it on a frame loom and figure it out. It just makes it accessible to so many more people who otherwise wouldn't have been able to even imagine it.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely true. And it's much like when I made the transition from craft fairs into teaching, and it made, you know, teaching made that ability to have something that comes from the hands more accessible because it came from your own hands. Yeah. And so this is just sort of taking that whole concept and going further. I mean, I have plenty of followers from Europe and it's really interesting, some of the questions. And of course there's a, you know, there's a bit of difficulty with the language sometimes. So I have to kind of look at the question a little bit and think, okay, they're talking in a different, they're translating from a different language, you know, how, what do they really mean? you know, just the whole thing, like in Germany, you know, we only use like 3/4, 3/8 inch seam allowances. Why are Americans so hung up on 5/8 of an inch? And I'm not positive why that is, but I can tell you the advantages of it and why I stick to it and sometimes even want more. And they're like, oh, good point. But, you know, this is just, we're so global now. What a joy. Mm. And in that is a bigger responsibility. That's why I went back and all my handouts, everything that I've written now has to go back and also have metric equivalents. Mm-hmm. Well, how snooty of me in the United States to think that everybody else in the world knows what an inch is.
Right.
Or 5/8 of an inch, you know. So now I even find myself in just a general conversation always saying, you know, 5/8 inch or 1.5 centimeters. Because, you know, 1/4 inch, 6 millimeters, you have to acknowledge that the entire rest of the world follows a different numbering system than you do.
Yeah.
And you want your work to be universal. So, you know, even the ends per inch, all my reads are done in, you know, imperial measurements, you know, that inch thing. And I don't have metric reads, but I should probably figure them out. And as I put drafts out there, put in parens what the, you know, what the metric equivalent of a, you know, an imperial read is.
Yeah. Mm.
We put together a project this year.
Oh.
And I believe that we put metric in it.
I think we did.
As well, yeah.
Which was new for us. And also this past year, I sewed myself a jumpsuit and it was all in metric. I had to learn, I had to sit, because it was from a French pattern company, and I was like, oh no, right. I don't know how to do 1.5 centimeter seam allowances. So it's like, oh, it's not that hard.
And to be perfectly honest with you, it makes so much more freaking sense. I don't know why we insist in this country to stay with this measuring system, because it makes no sense and it's not incremental enough. And I'm actually starting to think more in terms of metric, especially when I'm doing pattern work, because it just makes so much more sense. Everything is divisible by 10 and it just makes, mm-hmm. it's perfectly logical. And so I have little charts all around my desk where I'm, you know, write this stuff that, you know, I can just glance over and get the equivalent. And and I know that, you know, if you want to, you know, 2.54 multiply will give you the metric and equivalent, and, you know, from how many inches you have it, you know. And I think about that a lot. And I have to think about, as a global community, respecting that it is not always about the United States.
Yes.
We won't go there politically, but you know, there is a huge world out there that I would like to reach and share my knowledge with, and seems very appreciative, but I have to be considerate.
Yeah. Mm. That's the new world that we're in.
Yeah. So I work a lot in print and design and stuff.
Okay.
And I've got this that gives me all the decimal equivalents of every 64th of an inch.
Oh, wow. Well, I have the decimal equivalents of up to an inch because I do that conversion a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that is, you know, especially when you have to figure out how much yards you need, you know, like, you know, and to be able to then convert that number, like, you know, what's 1 3/4 yards? Well, you have to be able to convert that into a decimal number to be then converted into metric.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, so I've gotten pretty skilled at those conversions. And, you know, once in a while I think, oh God, did I do this right? And then I look and, you know, when you miss one, it's glaringly obvious, you know,
right.
But there's a lot of new skill sets that I've had to learn as I am more considerate of others that follow different systems than we do. And I yield, you know, I gratefully yield.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure.
So I have a random question. As somebody else who has 30 looms in in our studio, what is your go-to loom that you work on? Like, what do you look for in a loom that's like your workhorse, what you really enjoy producing on?
You know, that is so funny that you just asked that, because I've taken up to walking every morning, I've just got up to 5 kilometers, you know, of a walk every morning. And I absolutely love it because it is the time that I'm silent and I'm watching every single day just one more increment towards spring, you know, here in New Jersey. And mm-hmm. and it is such a gift. But it was so interesting because this morning, as I'm one of the routes that I take takes me by these small apartments, there's an apartment complex across town. And I looked at these people, you know, and these small spaces, and I always dream about, you know, downsizing into just a couple of rooms, which will never happen and can never happen. But what if I had to just take one loom with me? I mean, literally, I went through this process this morning, and it said, well, it would have to be I do have one loom. We have two looms in here, two table looms that are 12 shaft, but every other loom here is 8 or 4.
Okay.
And so it would have to be at least an 8 shaft. I mean, it would have to be an 8 shaft because that gives me more flexibility.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I couldn't pick one in my discussion with myself this morning. I probably the most comfortable loom I have. So 13 of the 35 looms I have are a brand called Tools of the Trade, which were made in Vermont by a really good furniture maker back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And my first loom that I ever got was a Tools of the Trade loom. And then I acquired a couple of more after that for, you know, this was a big 45-inch, you know, rock maple 8 shaft with the sectional beams and the whole thing. And then I acquired kind of a baby sister of it, also 8 shaft, to be able to take to workshops and demonstrations at craft fairs. So both of them have just amazing possibilities. But on the other hand, I mean, my body's getting old and, you know, trying to lift rock maple shafts and, you know, do 8 shaft on that is, although I do it, I acquired since an 8 shaft 36 version of that, which I actually like more because it's less loom and it's just easier on my body.
Yeah.
But then I have a couple of 8 shaft table looms, which are great for portability. And if I want to take a workshop, but then I have the little 16 inch one, which is what I do demos on. So this is like, there's no way to decide. And what I put on one is depending on which one's available and will do the job most efficiently. I also have, I think 18 or 19 little baby 8-inch Structos. A couple of them are 8 shaft, but I have these little Structos that I would load into the car and go and become a mobile weaving studio that I could teach beginning classes. And we were actually doing them pretty regularly for Silk City Fibers, whose outlet, main, you know, location is just 40 minutes from me towards Manhattan. And, you know, that of course had to stop with COVID, but I was hoping to turn that part of that business over to my daughter, because, you know, teaching beginning weaving and being able to bring the looms to you is a cool thing that not a lot of people can do.
Yeah.
So I have all these baby Structos. And so, you know, all the looms that we have collectively equal 35, but each one has its own purpose. And so I don't know how I would ever, you know, pick my favorite. I think my favorite is probably the 36 because it's just but it still has the capability to do large yardage and, you know, and it is 8 shaft and it has 2 back beams on it. So I can put, you know, dual tensioning, you know, of a warp and, you know, but I just picked up this really early Tools of the Trade loom that we kind of had to refurbish from somebody in Massachusetts for a couple $100. And my daughter went up and picked it up. And it's just 4 shaft. It's 32 inches wide, but it just weaves yardage so easily. And I'm thinking, but I like that one too.
Yeah.
This sounds exactly like the conversation we would have if we had to keep one loom.
Yeah, this I feel this so much because like when I explain to people I have 30 looms, they're like, oh, they're all floor looms. Where do you keep them? I'm like, no, I have tapestry looms. I have inkle looms. I have table looms. I have looms for anything that I ever want to do. And the other day we were talking about like possibly downsizing and I'm like, I don't even know where to begin.
Well, and then we were talking about possibly upsizing.
Yes.
The downsizing led into a conversation of like, but you know what would be really cool? Is if we got a new loom.
Oh, I love this. Just so you know, my 35 looms are all shaft looms. I didn't count the, you know, the 20 frame looms that I use for tapestry teaching. And I didn't count all of the Inca looms I have for teaching purposes. I mean, yeah. There's probably 50 or 60 looms in the studio.
All right. So we got some catching up to do.
It's not a competition. Right. So Eric, yeah, you got a ways to go. But it is, you know, when things come by me that makes sense, I will tell you there is one loom that I'm still, everything will move aside for if it ever becomes available, because there were very few made. But the Tools of the Trade loom, there were some 12 shaft ones out there. And yeah. I have one of my guildmates actually owns one, a full size floor loom, 12 shaft. And I would like to have one because I'm, you know, that committed to the brand and I know it. And all of the piece parts for all the looms interchange with each other, which is great. Oh. Same reeds, same heddles, everything. But, you know, if I acquired a 12 shaft one, I have no idea where the hell I would put it. And I don't know what here I could actually get rid of. But I would find a way, even if it went into my living room. You know, yep. Because, you know, there is a bit of a loom rescue thing that happens, you know, when one comes your way that you just feel strongly about and it needs to come and live in your house. Kind of like people do that with cats and dogs. I do it with looms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm particular, but, you know, there are, I think, loom gods that smile on you when you do rescue one and you bring it back to life and you get a warp on it and you let it do what it's designed to do. You know, yeah. I think it's a living, breathing thing. And I think that there's karma points in that.
Yeah. I think the last loom we acquired was a standing vertical floor loom. So it has yes. treadles on the bottom, but you weave vertically standing up. And it is so cool.
A Tissart.
It's a Tissart. So it yep. was from Leclerc.
Yep. And, tapestry, yep.
Yep. And I'm like, oh, imagine the things that I can do on this. This is such a cool piece of equipment that I don't think I'll see again. So that
yeah, you don't come across a lot of Tissarts.
Yeah.
Yeah, in beautiful condition. I mean, it was well loved and taken care of. And then when the woman who owned it died, they basically just closed her studio. So it had some dust on it. You know.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is waiting for a time where I'm ready to start doing some of those vertical tapestry works.
So here's one for you. So my guild just had a meeting earlier in the week, and we had one of our guild members who is really into freeform tapestry. She teaches around, and she gave us a guild lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically showed these little frame looms, and she has one from Shack that just stands up. So it stands up in an A-frame that allows you to then look at it in a vertical, which is a really interesting perspective. So anyway, as I'm watching this and, you know, and of course I've done what she's talking about many years, but suddenly I was excited to think, you know, I mean, I don't have the property you have, but I have this lovely property in suburban North Jersey that has ponds and gazebos and walkways and gardens. And I suddenly want to warp up that tapestry loom and take it outside
yeah.
and be able to sit and, you know, put stuff from the garden in it and to build this small tapestry, or in your case, it would be a large tapestry. but using the world around me, because this has been my salvation, you know, this house and its property, because that's all I've had for the last year. I haven't gone anywhere.
Right.
And so I think that there's some COVID peace coming out of that as to celebrate what has protected us in this past year. And yeah. I actually have my son who worked for Target brought it home one Christmas. It was it's a loom that has a base on it upright tapestry loom that sits on a little base.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, he picked it up in the sale rack at Target and he said, "Here, Mom." And I went, "Oh God." And then I thinking, "Oh my God, this could stand on the table in the gazebo and I could weave on it outside." And, you know, and I thought, and I actually got really excited about that.
Yeah. I have a little Mirex loom that I inherited from Eric's mother, and it fits right in a tote bag. Has a little stand, and it is my...
Yeah, it's like little legs kick out.
Yeah, yep. And it's my yep. camping loom. Like, whenever we go to a cabin or go camping, I bring some yarn with me, and it goes right in my tote bag, and that's what I work on all week. And it is...
I love that.
The greatest. It is one of the greatest little things I've ever... And if if college Tegan could talk to current Tegan, she would probably roll her eyes and be like, why are you doing tapestry? But it's like, it is such a different pace.
Absolutely. With a different goal.
Yeah.
You know, it is creativity at its best, especially if it's free form. You just kind of wing it. You know, you're not following a design that's, you know, that you have a goal with. Right. And freeform tapestry is just being in the moment with what is surrounding you, with what little pile of yarn is in your hand, and seeing where it takes you with no goal. There's no money attached to it. There's no deadline attached to it. And it is us being allowed to be the creative beings that we are.
Yeah.
And nothing may end up ever coming from it. But for that moment, you are just being one with that thread. And it is a gift. And I'm so excited to look forward to the good weather when I can actually set this little loom up and take it out there and just do that for the moment. You know, I totally get it.
We have this beautiful screened in back porch that looks out the field behind our house. And last summer, I think I spent the entire summer out on the porch. I even moved a floor loom out there so I could weave out in the sunshine.
Wow.
But it's like, I'm ready for it. The winter has done its job. And I told Eric, I think this is the first summer I'm actually excited about.
Yeah.
In a long time.
Yeah, it feels like, well, I also feel like you can sort of feel the energy building, like the creative energy building with a lot of people. And like, I really hope deep down inside me that we do get like widespread vaccinations and we can at least start getting together in small groups like this summer. So, because I feel like if we can at least do that, that's going to kick off some crazy creativity. And I'm just so ready to see it, experience it, create it. I'm ready for it. And I think that there's a lot of people out there that are ready for it. And when it comes back, it's going to come back like so strong. And I just I'm like excited. I can like,
it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah. Yeah. I can feel it coming.
And I, you know, my hat's off to the people that use this time to explore things they never would have explored, baking bread to the point where you couldn't buy yeast, you know, sewing, mask making, you know, and sewing machines. You know, right now it's, you can't get like a low-end sewing machine because they're like, there aren't any because everybody scarfed them up. You know, people ask me all the time, I'm like, what sewing machine do you recommend? I'm like, well, but it's not available. You have to wait till, you know, it catches up and then gets shipped in from, you know, Japan or China, wherever that particular brand is being made. And we just don't have them. And so, you know, people are digging out, dusting off stuff, the equipment from the 40s just to get through. And people are becoming resourceful. Mm-hmm. They're becoming creative. They're exploring, you know, areas like cooking and baking and bread making and stuff that they have never done before. And I'm hoping, just like you are, that when we begin to meet again and we begin to reconnect, that all of that doesn't just disappear and people go, oh, thank God I'm on my regular, or they look at it and say, you know, there was a lot to be learned from that time I spent gardening and at home and, you know, baking and making bread. And what can I do to maintain that serenity that it brought me? And as I slowly add back in, you know, the commitments and craziness that I had, you know, before the pandemic, I think it taught us all a lot.
Yeah.
It taught me a lot. It taught me so much that I don't want to do what I was doing anymore. You know, I'd read back over my blog posts and I think I was crazy. I mean, how did I have any life at all? I mean, it was crazy. It was painful reading some of those blog posts, that, you know, where I just returned from and I did this and this and this. And I just went on to that one. And, you know, and I'm thinking, how did I even breathe?
Right.
And this year of slowness and thoughtfulness and reevaluating what's important has brought, you know, to mind a new vision of where I see myself now moving forward.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky I'm in a position to make that happen.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
for sure.
Yeah,
us too.
My therapist at like towards the beginning of the pandemic was like, okay, you need a hobby. You need something that isn't work that you can just, if it fails, it's okay. It's not a big deal. And I was like, okay, fine. I need a hobby. Even though
the problem is that
you knew what I did for a living.
Right?
The problem is that every hobby for both of us just turns into work.
Right.
But I have found two things.
Yep.
I make my own kombucha. And I learned how to make sourdough. So I make, every once in a while, I'll make sourdough waffles and I make sourdough cinnamon rolls. Mm-hmm. I got really good at it. But it's not anything that is like takes up a lot of time, is crazy. It's just right. Like, oh, it's food science. It's,
maybe once a week.
Yeah, once a week I like right. bottle my kombucha. Yeah.
You know, but you're right. And it was so actually a number of years ago, I was, you know, I'm getting into that burnout. I was teaching so much. I wasn't having any time in my own studio. When I'm in my studio, it's more work. And I needed a hobby. And yeah. I actually took up music.
Yeah.
Because it is the complete antithesis of what I do. I picked up a plastic recorder and I started to learn to play it. I knew how to read music because I'd studied piano as a kid, but I found a friend and we would play duets together. And then a third friend, we'd play trios together. And I was very bad at it, but I, you know, kept at it and they were patient. But having a hobby that is so different than what everybody else's hobby is, you know, because right. what, you know, this is not a hobby. This is what I've been doing for the last 50 years of my life. And there's joy in it again, which is great, but it's not a hobby.
Right.
You're absolutely right. And I remember that one of the things that really struck me about music, unlike what I do here, you know, playing an instrument, especially performing, is that, you know, and I joined a group that performed, you know, locally a couple of places and nerve wracking and all of that. But it was a really good exercise for me because think about this, you know, and the same thing with making sourdough and everything. If I make a mistake here in anything that has to do with cloth, we already talked about that. I can cut it out, rip it out, take it apart, remake it into something else, go to plan B.
Right.
When you are playing an instrument in performance and you make a mistake, you cannot even acknowledge it. You must keep going because otherwise, you know, the first time it happened to me, I was like, and then I completely lost where I was and I had to drop out because I had no idea where we even were in the score. And, right. you know, you learn to just keep going and not even acknowledge. And it's something you cannot correct. That yeah. was huge for me to learn. Huge. And the same thing, if you mess up the sourdough, if you bake it too long or you forget it or it's whatever, you know, it's done. You throw it yeah. away. And, you know, and there's something very different about that than fiber. And the other thing that, of course, now with COVID has become very apparent, but what I loved about playing an instrument was that it was a communal event and yeah. that especially recorders, there is no leader. You know, you have to listen to each other, both in pitch and tempo and work as a unit. That was absolutely something I did not know how to do and did not have any skill set for because I'm a solo person. Right. I'm a teacher. I ran craft fairs. I sold my work. I was always solo and the one in charge. Mm. And to be able to learn to work as a team was really hard for me.
Yeah.
So I picked a challenging hobby and it's funny because through COVID I didn't need it. It's fun. I had, because it was a joy now in what I do here. So I know I once in a while will pick it up. And through last summer when we could meet outside, a couple of friends would come over and we would play on the deck, but I haven't needed it the way, because now this is my friend again. This is a hobby now and I can explore and create and not feel that it's so business oriented.
Yeah. Mm. My goal within the next 5 years, even it seems like a long time, but in reality, with all the stuff that we're doing, it seems like reasonable. I'm actually a classically trained flute player. So I am going to fix up my flute and I am going to set up a little practice studio somewhere in the house so mm-hmm. I don't disturb anyone. And I'm going to get back into flute music because it's the same thing. It's a different... Right. a different process, a different feeling. And when you make a mistake, it's just out there. You just got to keep going. Mm-hmm. And I miss that part in my life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And if you're classically trained, you were really trained for performance and you were trained, you know, to be a business, but now you can go back to that flute and it's just for you to create that music in that moment. And, exactly. And so, you know, I was working on the Brandenburg Concerto on recorder, which is, which you have played on the flute, but you know, it was a little more challenging for me on the record on an alto recorder, but, and the speed of which I will never do, but yeah, no. You know, when we all play, we're like, okay, can we take this at a quarter tempo? You know, like, and it's fine. It sounds beautiful, you know, but it is. And you know, when you nail the note and you nail that phrase, you know, there's just some personal joy in that, but it is very ephemeral. I mean, it's just, it's here and it's gone.
Yeah.
You know? And, so music is, I think, a wonderful hobby that we can all do. And actually, there are a number of books that I just discovered that I bought because they have CDs of the accompaniment, the harpsichord accompaniment. And you can just follow along and play with the harpsichord accompaniment and feel like you're actually part of something. Except that harpsichord keeps going even when you mess up. And you're like,
right, right. I know that was my favorite thing. I would get these CDs of piano accompaniments. Uh-huh. And I played jazz flute for a couple years and it was it was so great. So someday I'll get back to it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. I think it's really important. And there are a lot of things that I went back to. I still have a piano because I studied piano as a kid. And I was actually thinking the other day, I should pull out some of my really old music and, you know, just play something easy because there's something, it connects with a different part of the brain.
Yeah.
Not only weaving and actually the part of the brain that weaving calculations and that kind of thing and music do share, I think, the same part of the brain, but the outcome is different and the feel is different because one is more, you know, takes time to develop and the other, it needs practice, but is here and it's gone.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of like sandcastles on the beach.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when we moved back here, I moved back in with my old drum set from when I was in, you know, grade school and high school. And it's been taunting me ever since we moved in.
So. And it will continue to taunt you, Eric, until you just sit down and, you know.
I know.
And there has to be a way to be able to mix the sound of the drum beat of a drum and a flute, which is very sort of tribal and Native American and, you know, and wind music. You know, it's just there is a beat there. And it would be really fun for you to actually find a way to connect those two pieces of music.
Yeah. That would be cool. My only response to that is that I think we do enough together.
Oh, okay. Well, that is completely fair. That is completely fair. And that's kind of like my morning walks, you know? I mean, I could encourage my daughter to go with me and bring the dogs, and I don't want to make it a family affair. I want to be alone.
Yeah.
For that.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I quite like the evenings. Tegan usually goes downstairs and weaves and works. And then I'll be up here and I'll be doing other business stuff, but I'll be in my office where it's quiet. I can listen to my music and hang out with the dog and we have our time. But we spend the rest of the day together, so.
Yeah.
It's nice to be apart for a little while.
It is. And, you know, my daughter and I even have a totally different sleep schedule. She gets up at noon, you know, by then I've already put in a half a day's work. And then, you know, she's up till God knows what hour in the morning, but I'm in bed by, you know, a normal human being bedtime hour. So it actually works because, you know, we are on different schedules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, she knows when she has to appear to do the filming and, you know, she knows what the deadline is to launch on a, you know, midnight on Friday morning. You know, the video of the week. And so, you know, she knows the schedule and, you know, as long as she does her job and I get to do mine. And, but I agree with you. I mean, it's really challenging when you live and work with someone that you're either, you know, that you're related to in some way, whether it was marriage or, you know, child parent or, but when you also live together, like nobody goes home to their own space.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's the other thing about that is that I am an only child. So I had a lot, I had all my own space, all my life. Yeah. If I didn't want to be around my parents, I just came in my room or went outside. And that was, you know, I just got away from people. And that was like the thing that I valued the most in my life. And then I met this one and we've been like, as my mother used to call it, Velcro heads. We would just be together all the time, you know, making up. Mom always thought, you know, that I was making up for lost time not having somebody around. And that is totally possible and could completely be what it is. But also,
That's what I need.
Right.
I need, because I grew up with siblings and we always did stuff together. And it's like, I need somebody to do something with me. Like, I do appreciate my alone time and I'll ask for it.
Yeah. But now that we're like, we own a business together and we're married and we go on vacation together and we, you know, do chores together and we, you know, so it's like sometimes we just need to chill.
Yeah. No, I completely get it, you know? And so I leave in the morning. I don't even bring the dog. I just walk and, you know, I just walk and I watch the birds and, you know, and I can hear, if you're real quiet, you can hear the woodpeckers starting to make their, you know, that, you know, and it's just a, you know, and you, if you, I used to walk with a friend who I actually had worked for me for a period of a couple of years and she moved, but, and I missed her, but then I realized I didn't, when I was walking with her, we chatter. And I love the quiet, the solitude, the time to think. And I'm really looking forward to using my gardens this year. And hopefully continue that solitude. That's the one thing this lovely house does not have is a screened-in porch. And I often thought I would probably maybe try to add one, but I'm thinking, but that's not realistic.
Right.
Because I don't want to spend any more money than I have. But, you know, but I have the outside and I can do that. And, and take a little tapestry loom out there and, you know.
Perfect.
See where it takes me.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many parallels there are, you know, in our
lives. It is. It's crazy.
I think this is a good point in the interview.
Good spot.
Hey guys.
All right.
Enjoy.
Call my mom back.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
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 Oh man, I hope that some of her insights encourage some of you like it encourages me.
Yeah, and if you have any interest in what she's doing, definitely check out her YouTube channel, The Weaver Sews. It's really insightful and very interesting. Another thank you goes out to Rawhead the Recluse for providing music for our podcast. Find him at rawheadtherecluse.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe now. It will help us reach more weavers and people who are passionate about hand-created textiles.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Professional Weaver Society, and you can get full show notes at proweaverpod.com.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Professional Weaver Podcast. We look forward to sharing more episodes with you each Friday.
Bye!